Favors its local restaurants, so maybe Grand Central Bakery or workers organizing for the right to form a union is kind of our Portland way. You know, instead of McDonald's workers, we've got our Grand Central Bakery workers, which is pretty cool. So, real quick, if anybody wants to support your campaign, where can they go to sign the change.org petition or to learn more?
Yeah, we have a petition going on change.org. You can find that on the Laborers 483, La Yuna 483 Facebook page and website.
LIUNA 483.org.
Laborers International Union of North America.
All right, looks like we are about out of time this week. Thank you, Casey, for coming in today. It's been great talking to you. And Fernando, it's good to hang out again.
See you again in a month.
All right. Thank you, Portland, for listening to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO would like to thank our community partners that donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Overlook Restaurant located at 1332 North Skidmore, a locally owned establishment for over 40 years serving American classics with Mediterranean specials. Lunch was provided by 808, located at 2454 East Burnside, serving Hawaiian plate lunch including Kalua pig, teriyaki, and loco moco, open daily at 11 a.m. Dinner was provided by Marrakesh, located at 1201 Northwest 21st, open daily 5 to 10 p.m., with belly dancing Wednesday through Sunday, serving Moroccan cuisine since 1989.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to the Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we're here with Mr. Alejandro Molina with the Boricua Human Rights Network. How are you doing?
Good, thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely, thanks for being on. And can you talk a little bit about the work that you're doing? There might be some listeners who don't necessarily even know what Boricua or Boricuan means, so maybe address that a little bit too, and your role in how you get involved in this particular work supporting political prisoners.
Sure. I think that, so I've been involved in political prisoner work, specifically Puerto Rican political prisoner work, since the late 1970s. When I first came to the work by being involved in the campaign to free the five nationalist prisoners, Lolita Lebron, Rafael Cantel Miranda, Oscar Collazo, Andres Figueroa Cordero, and Evelyn Flores, who were pardoned by President Jimmy Carter in September of 1979 after spending, four of them spent 25 years in prison and one of them 29, and actually Rafael Cantel Miranda spent 25, but he had had already spent 2 years in prison for refusing the draft as a youth. What they call in Puerto Rico servicio militar obligatorio, the draft, the forced draft. So all of these people were Puerto Rican nationalists, and four of them, led by Lili Pedregón, had done a symbolic attack on the U.S. House of Representatives on March 1st, 1954, shooting at the ceiling, and bullets had ricocheted and wounded five U.S. congressmen. And they were sentenced, and their sentence ultimately was commuted by President Jimmy Carter, as I mentioned. Now, the fifth prisoner, and that's interesting because it takes us to sort of the whole point of the current plight of Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera, was Oscar Collazo. Oscar Collazo was one of two Puerto Rican nationalists that tried to assassinate President Harry Truman on November 1st, 1950. The other Puerto Rican nationalist, Griselio Torresola, was killed in a shootout with a guard. Oscar Collazo was wounded and sentenced to death by electric chair. After a worldwide campaign in which the Pope at that time played a crucial role, President Harry Truman commuted his sentence to life imprisonment. And then it was commuted, you know, in 1979, along with the four others. I say that because U.S. presidents have commuted, three U.S. presidents have commuted the sentences of specifically of Puerto Rican political prisoners in the 30, going on 40 plus years that they have been in office. President Harry Truman, President Jimmy Carter, and President Bill Clinton in 1999 commuted the sentences of 11 Puerto Rican political prisoners, most of whom were arrested on April 4th, 1980, and June 30th, 1983. I say that because they had already served 20 years, well, a combination of 16 and a half and 20 years in prison, and had were the object of an international campaign to win their freedom, in which broad sectors of Puerto Rican society, as well as Latin America and in the U.S., had been pressuring President Clinton for their release. And I say that because once he commuted their sentence, there was a firestorm, and I don't know if anybody remembers it, but there was an attempt to impeach President Clinton that very week because of that. Anyway, I think that's sort of the introduction to, it sets the stage for the campaign around Oscar Lopez Rivera, the only long-term Puerto Rican political prisoner still in jail.
And I forget all the names myself. I remember one or two. For example, under Clinton, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but Dilcia Paigan was one of those people. And actually around that time, too, there was a few of the kind of white anti-imperialist weather people who also were pardoned by Clinton, Susan Rosenberg, and some other folks. What's the deal with Oscar's case? Why do you think, you know, Oscar's still in, but Dilcia, you know, a few of these people have been let out over the year and pardoned?
Well, I think all of them, there are no more. In fact, the last one was just freed January 15th, I think, of this year. Norberto Gonzalez Claudio, who served 5 years for what the government alleges was his role in the expropriation of a Wells Hartford, Wells Fargo depot in 1983. He was underground. He was on the run, literally, for 22 years and was arrested 5 years ago at the age of 62. And because he had a health condition, he and his lawyer and negotiated a plea bargain, and without having to give up any information that the government would have tried to say that he had, he got out in January. So I think Oscar is still in prison, and I want to make this clear. clear, because he didn't want to leave anybody behind. At the time of the Clinton clemency, two of the prisoners were, one had not, was not even mentioned, and one was not offered a deal. Carlos Alberto Torres and Aida Beltran, who years later both got out, they maxed out, one got out on parole, but they both did 30 years, and this is in 2008 and 2010. Oscar, as part of being made an offer, said that told the Clinton administration he would refuse the offer as long as he had two comrades that were going to stay in prison. And the other part was the offer they made him, and people don't generally know this, was that he served 10 more years and remain in prison without a single disciplinary incident in those 10 years. Obviously, we felt on the outside that this was a setup. Mm-hmm. It was the easiest way to get to what would be to violate him and say that, of course, something had happened and he didn't keep his end of the bargain, as well as having to deal with the fact that there were two other comrades that were still inside.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to just hear from some lovely folks volunteering with KBOO tonight who are going to help to persuade you to send KBOO billions of dollars as soon as you can. So let's hear from them, and we'll get back to this interview.
Thanks so much, Adam. It's Ani, and I'm here with Amy. And we are here, well, not so much to persuade you, but to inform you as to why it is important that you call. Well, okay, not call, but then you go to the website, kboo.fm, right now, and you can become a member of community radio. It's true. There seems to be some sort of major construction accident, you know, faux pas. And it has knocked out the phone lines for us and several other people in the immediate area. But it daunts us not, because we know you are there, we know you are listening, and that you can, in fact, still connect with us via the internets. If you go to kboo.fm/give, you can get directly to our membership area of the website, and you can support KBOO and keep us strong and independent. Isn't that right, Amy?
Mm-hmm. That's where you can give your billions of dollars that you've got lying around, or you can also give us as little as $5 a month. And choosing a monthly payment is something that can really help you to spread out your support and keep KBOO consistently supported. It also makes the impact a little bit less on your wallet. So instead of putting the $1 billion in at one time, you can spread your $1 billion payment out over the course of a year. And that's the most popular way to do it right now. And the easiest way to do it is to go to kboo.fm/give and type in all your information and click OK.
It's so easy to do. Just takes a couple minutes of your time. You could also stop by here, 20 Southeast 8th. And we're right in between Burnside and Ankeny and beautiful, scenic Southeast 8th Avenue here in central Portland. You can drop by. We'll give you a tour of the studios. And, you know, we'll show you how your money is spent. We'll show you how community media is made and show you how you can be as much of it as you ever wanted to be. You can contribute just $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month, what you can work into your monthly budget. We would love to accept. But the thing is, we just really want your participation. Give us a one-time gift of $40. That's our regular membership, and we'll be extremely excited that you've joined us. Please do just go ahead and use those internets to become an active supporting member of KBOO Community Radio right now. Go to kboo.fm.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7. For those of you just tuning in, we are here with Alejandro Molina from the Boricua Human Rights Network, talking specifically about long-term U.S.-held political prisoner, prisoner of war, Oscar Lopez Rivera. And Alejandro, getting back into this, one thing maybe some of our listeners might not understand really is talking about the struggle for Puerto Rican independence and what that means. I think some people get very confused about the difference between a commonwealth, a protectorate, versus being a being colonial, which many of us argue is the case for Puerto Rico. And so can you kind of flesh that out a little bit in Oscar's role in that struggle, his background?
Sure. In some ways, I think, there's an argument. A good friend of ours, as we've started to have this discussion, Erica Abad, about what the term post-colonial means. And I've always said to her, I'll be post-colonial in the post-imperial.
Mm-hmm.
I say that because one of the things that people, I think that's easy to argue is that the era of colonialism is past. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's true at all. Obviously, you still see vestiges of colonialism as well as outright colonies the world over, but specifically in the Western Hemisphere, Puerto Rico is a colony no matter how it's branded. So much so that the people who want statehood for Puerto Rico actively argue that it's also a colony and it needs a healthy dose of self-determination mm-hmm. in order to become the 51st state. So I say that because by any, and to me, one of the mistakes that we as activists make is sort of assume that it's important that people understand our whole worldview, and I would argue that it's important that they understand, or that we understand as activists, that colonialism is wrong by any definition. Right? One thing is sort of the varnish of the phraseology, commonwealth, or the legal apparatus, right, that's layered on top of the colony, of the infrastructure, to say, well, this is different, it's not slavery, it's not. But the fact of the matter is, Puerto Rico is a colony, and generations of Puerto Rican men and women have gone to prison since 1898, mm-hmm. since the invasion of Puerto Rico on July 25th, 1898, by General Nelson A. Miles at the port city of Guanica. Right? Mm-hmm. So Oscar is sort of the latest, and in some ways he is the most representative in this age, which we should be past colonialism. In fact, it was the decade of the 1990s which the United Nations called for an end to colonialism, calling it for what it was, a mm-hmm. crime against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I say that because Oscar, when he came to the United States, he moved here when he was 14 years old. He grew up. He also remembers that only in the United States, in his limited experience, could you, where you live, defined what you would have as services, the quality of the school, the quality of the neighborhood, if you'd be able to go to the area church, right, if you were made fun of. And so he grew up as this young man, really, really bright, but constantly struggling around the racist forces in the city of Chicago. And yet, when he was drafted, he went. He saw no problem with it. You know, he also tells me that for him, as many other people, Vietnam was one the single transformative event in his life.
Mm-hmm.
When he came back, he didn't see things the same. He saw that the Puerto Rican community in the U.S. and specifically in Chicago was one that had to be transformed only because it was not only poor or people were poverty-stricken, but there were structural problems with the way people were perceived and objectified, that it was in fact a transplant of their colonial situation in which they changed space, geographical space, but not situation, right? So those power relationships that moved with them from the colony went with them to the metropole.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he immediately became involved in founding institutions and struggling around issues, bread and butter issues like housing, healthcare, education, voting rights, right, and was successful along with the generation that followed the 1966 riot in Puerto Rico in spanning a new generation of leadership in the Puerto Rican community of Chicago. That generation following the 66 riot gave us Congressman Luis Gutierrez, gave us a whole host of not-for-profit community leaders in housing, education, healthcare, and it also gave us Puerto Rican revolutionaries like Oscar Lopez Rivera. So I think that Oscar Vietnam veteran who had faced the atrocities and was part of them in Vietnam, but came home determined to change things, and that's where he became involved in the campaign to free the five nationalists, and later on in the work around an independent Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the conditions that Oscar is dealing with? You know, there's always, you know, that talk about different prisoners, you know, political prisoners, and them being in some of the worst prisons in the United States. And it's kind of interesting, I guess, to say that, right? Because what's like the worst of two evils anyways? But just maybe briefly just talk about that.
Okay. Well, I think in some ways, you know, sort of are becoming so attuned to a visual culture, a pop culture of movies, of YouTube, which is both good and bad, because on one hand, we see, you know, prison movies or movies that talk about prison life, or in some ways they become glamorous. But the fact of the matter is the United States is constantly in the lead for being the country in the world with the most people under the jurisdiction of its criminal justice system, and of the population under the jurisdiction of its criminal justice system, the vast majority are people of color. Mm-hmm. So if this is true for the general population, right, China notwithstanding, then I would argue that political prisoners, and this goes to your question, usually face the most difficult conditions, in the sense that Oscar has spent 12.2 years of his 33 years in prison so far in two of the worst prisons, in complete sensory deprivation, in complete lockdown. Mm-hmm. And that was United States Penitentiary Marion, mm-hmm. Illinois, and ADX Florence, Colorado. Florence, Colorado was built Marion was built as a replacement for Alcatraz on the West Coast, right? It was built in 1963, and it was built as the most modern for the worst of the worst, right? 20 years later, after it had been on lockdown since 1972, when there was a prison uprising and two guards were killed, it became a prison that was permanently locked down to this day, right? So they built ADX Florence, Administrative Unit Florence, which is really a prison with four prisons. It's a camp, it's a FCI, a Federal Correctional Institution, mm-hmm. a United States Penitentiary, which is a higher level of security, and the maximum security, ADX, in Colorado, and it was built as a solution to Marion. This is where there was an active marketing campaign that said, this is where the worst of the worst will reside. John Gotti, the mafia kingpin, Ray Levasseur, a white revolutionary, mm-hmm. Oscar Lopez Rivera, right? And I believe that Amnesty International, as far back as 1970, started analyzing the effects of long-term sensory deprivation and declared it tantamount to torture. Mm-hmm. So, in these days, you can just go on Netflix and you see specials by National Geographic. There's a commercial movie out, but it's all about sensory deprivation. In New York State, they're passing laws that you can't, only because they understand the damage that it's doing, about cutting down the amount of time that you can legally spend in isolation. Right? I think that the world is on the verge of a sea change in recognizing the idea that sensory deprivation is not about pushing people or coercing people. It's completely about a punitive form of isolation that leads to, I believe, isolation, and it attempts to psychologically break down the prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Alejandro, we want to thank you so much for being on tonight, and we're going to get back into our pledge drive here for the last few minutes of the program. But before we close out, can you tell our listeners how to keep in touch, how they can get involved and learn more about Oscar and the work that you're doing?
Absolutely. I'll be quick. So this May stabilization for Oster. We hope to raise between, to move between 5,000 to 10,000 people. Our website is BoricuaHumanRights.org. We have a 100,000 letter petition campaign going on to Barack Obama. You can download it at the website. And as always, you can email us at info@BoricuaHumanRights.org.
All right. And we're going to make sure we get you back on KBOO very, very soon. Again, want to thank our guests. Tune in next week. Karen James will interview Bob June Deaf, Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, currently introducing a bill that will stop solitary confinement for persons with serious mental illness incarcerated in Oregon prisons. Don't forget to listen to this and previous Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Again, thanking our guests. Thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Have a great evening. Free them all, and see you next week.
And you have just heard some amazing reasons to support Community Radio KBOO. This is the Winter Membership Drive. I'm Ani. I'm here with Amy, who is a member of the Prison Pipeline Collective. And you've just heard Adam wrapping up another amazing episode of, you know, information that's relevant, that's important, that's pertinent, that we need to know. It's not necessarily the most pleasant of information. Who wants to think about people being subjected to sensory deprivation and things that are tantamount to torture? It's not something that I want to dwell on, and yet it happens. It happens to people in this country, and it needs to be something that is in our consciousness so that Absolutely. We can share this information and we can make movement to to actually better the situation, to actually have correction systems that make sense. And you can be a part of this by joining us at kboo.fm.
Yeah, the easiest URL is the kboo.fm/give. We've also got a tip jar up in the top bar of our website. You can click on that and start your donation. I was just flipping through some thank you gifts we've got. I noticed we've got, for a $60 donation, a really cool KBOO mug, and I when I saw it instantly, I longed to have that mug, and I'm sure that you would feel the same way if you saw the mug. It's just a $60 donation. You can either become a renewing member, one-time donation of $60, or you can split that out over the year, which is $5 a month, and that's a really great way. We can now do that with your credit card or debit card. It's very convenient. It's really secure as well, and it's on our website at kboo.fm/give. And you have your own reasons for giving, and we definitely understand that. And we know that programming on Prison Pipeline is one of the reasons that you are probably thinking about giving, because this is not the type of programming you do hear on the radio commonly. It is becoming more popular to talk about prison reform on all media sites, but talking about specifically Oscar Lopez Rivera and all that he's going through is something that you're not gonna get other places.
It's true. It's so true. And KBOO has been here talking about prisoner reform and even prison abolition movements mm-hmm. for many, many years now. And it is important, I think, to see ourselves connected to a movement bigger than our own individual selves. And KBOO is a part of so many movements. We provide that microphone, that platform for organizers and activists in so many different areas to come together and share this information direct to each other, to you, the community members who provide the financial support to keep the station going. Do please contribute, join us, be a part of KBOO Community Radio at kboo.fm. Contribute monthly. It's so easy to do. As Amy was just saying, you can put it on your credit card or debit card. You can take it straight out of your checking account. You can set it up for as little as $5 a month and on towards anything you would like to set it at. And it's an easy way to give $60 or $180 or $240 over the course of a year in easy, tiny, bite-sized pieces. I know I myself am giving $20 a month because I really wanted that KBOO hoodie. It's a beautiful black zip-up hoodie. It's true. And it's got this great star, like a red star behind the KBOO radio tower. It's got this great cog. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful graphic. Brings a tear to my eye. It does. And I got it for just a $20 contribution here to my community radio station, KBOO. So I know I'm doing my part, keeping media free, keeping KBOO's lights on for the entire community. And I get a really cool hoodie. All in the deal. It's easy to do. You can come down in person, 20 Southeast 8th. Here on between Burnside and Ankeny on Southeast 8th Avenue, or you can just go online, kboo.fm. Isn't that right?
It sure is, yeah. It's super easy to walk in the door. We'll show you the studio. You get an idea of how we spend your money. You can easily also make the donation at kboo.fm. There's just some other shows that we had on Prison Pipeline. Last week we had an update on Mumia Abu-Jamal. We've had programming on allyship in the age of abolition, prison abolition movements, community parenting alternatives that are in Washington State, where they're actually keeping mothers out of prison so that they can stay with their children. And these types of shows are really important, things that you don't always get to hear and know about, but you do want to know, and you support it by going online to kboo.fm, clicking on the tip jar, and making a donation right now. Thanks so much.
KBOO would like to thank our community partners that donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Overlook Restaurant, located at 1332 North Skidmore, a locally owned establishment for over 40 years serving American classics with Mediterranean specials. Lunch was provided by 808, located at 2454 East Burnside, serving Hawaiian plate lunch including kalua pig, teriyaki, and loco moco, open daily at 11 a.m. Dinner was provided by Marrakesh, located at 1201 Northwest 21st. Open daily 5 to 10 p.m. with belly dancing Wednesday through Sunday, serving Moroccan cuisine since 1989.
Let's hear from Amy Goodman, founder and host of Democracy Now!
You appreciate the work of KBOO and of Democracy Now!, your daily, grassroots, global, unembedded, independent, international investigative news hour. Please call in and show your support. The number to call is 877-500-5266. It's the lifeline of KBOO, that phone number. Please call. This is the winter membership drive of KBOO, and it means so much to us that KBOO is right there in Portland, Oregon. And right now, though, we're asking you to make the call that makes the difference, to ring for freedom of the media. We urge you to call. We ask you to stand up for independent media, 877-500-5266.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 7:03 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's our evening broadcast of Hard Knock Radio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's really going on? This is Boost from the Coup with Hard Knock Radio. You gotta be there.
What up, y'all? It's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio. News, views, hip-hop.
What up, everybody? Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. You know, public housing, housing projects, the PJs, they simultaneously have represented in this country the ultimate in accomplishment, They were housing projects at one point where dreams come true, the manifestation of how good this country can be. And simultaneously, their existence has represented the complete failure of our society, the demonization of people who lived in those projects, underscoring failure of urban renewal programs and safety nets. You have famous projects like the Robert Taylor Houses and Cabrini Green in Chicago, both of which have been torn down. We have the Pink Palace in San Francisco and New York, where I'm from. You have, famous housing projects like Queensbridge and Bronx River and Eden Wall, which, interestingly enough, is still standing, but are still pointed to as a symbol of what is wrong with this country and its income inequality. We have the famous projects in New Orleans, which were destroyed. They withstood Katrina, but then they were taken down by man who wanted to make a political point. One of the more famous ones is Pruitt-Igoe, which is in St. Louis. It was considered a housing marvel, as with the other projects that I mentioned. And two decades later, it found itself in rubble. And they talk about this in a documentary. It's a historical documentary that centers on the analysis of the massive impact of the national urban renewal programs in the 1950s and 60s, which prompted the process of mass, and I'm quoting here, suburbanization, and emptied American cities and their residents, businesses, and industries. Those left behind in the city faced a destitute, rapidly deindustrialized arena, parceled out to downtown interests, and increasingly segregated by class and race. And this documentary focuses on what was a highlight and what was a marvel, as I mentioned, in St. Louis. And so I want you all to take a listen to this and, you know, put on your social justice lens and listen to all the, or take into account all the other factors, all the other issues that come into play when we talk about housing and poverty and black and brown folks and poor people who are forced to live in some of these places and what they once meant and what they mean today. So we're going to jump into this. We're going to go to cut one from the documentary Pruitt-Igoe Myth. Here we go, right here.
In 2005, columnist Sylvester Brown began a series of articles on the Pruitt-Igoe public housing development where he once resided as a child. The North Side St. Louis site on which Pruitt-Igoe once stood is now vacant.
And I followed this dusty little path, and I walked up this path, and I sat on this big mound of concrete and dirt. I just sat there and I reflected, and the sun was going down. And I remembered as a child looking out my 10th story window and watching the sun go down. So the memories started to come back. And as I was sitting there, I heard this. I looked across and there was this black dog just running. Running out of there. And then I had this idea that the slathering dog would jump on my back. But I made it out of there. And I remember sitting outside there panting and being afraid. And I was afraid again. Feeling this fear that I felt when I was 6 years old. The danger of being a Pruitt-Igoe.
These developments are run by the St. Louis Housing Authority. This is a far cry from the crowded, collapsing tenements that many of these people have known. Here in bright new buildings with spacious grounds, they can live. Live with indoor plumbing, electric lights, fresh plastered walls, and the rest of the conveniences that are expected in the 20th century. In these projects, children can play in safety on the wide lawn. not in the littered alleys and vacant lots.
It was touted as the solution, a cure for the disease. Puritago would rise above the polluted slums, lifting its residents out of poverty. They would thrive, and the city would prosper. Everything would be different.
It was a very beautiful place, like a big hotel resort, I'd say, with plenty of green grass, trees, shrubbery, and all the works.
What happened?
Well, one day we woke up and it was all gone.
In the middle 50s, St. Louis thought it had solved its low-cost housing needs, but instead, a monster was created.
But things changed quickly. As problems mounted, the decline was steep. Those who could move out did.
12,000 people were originally jammed into these 33 buildings. Only 2,500 people still linger in the remaining shells.
It became poor, increasingly segregated, heavily vandalized, and began to resemble the slums it replaced.
Pruitt-Igoe looks like a battleground. Vandalism and neglect have left fear among the remaining occupants.
Crime rates rose. Fear grew. Conditions worsened. Outsiders stayed away. It had become notorious.
Some projects became breeding grounds for crime. The Pruitt-Igoe project in St. Louis is a casebook example.
In St. Louis, Missouri today, the health of an ailing neighborhood got some long and badly needed treatment.
Though in St. Louis today, they were hard at work again, this time tearing down what was built before.
2 decades after opening Pruitt-Igoe, the government gave up.
And because they are so desperate, they are willing to try desperate things.
It was a powerful story, with a dramatic end. The footage was replayed again and again. One image seemed to sum up the infamy. It circulated worldwide. It was reprinted next to photos from earlier years and suggested a simple question. What caused the failure? The Pruitt-Igoe myth begins here.
When critics talk of the failures of federally funded high-rise housing projects, they often cite the example of the huge Pruitt-Igoe project in St. Louis.
Some blame the architect. Modernist high-rises like Pruitt-Igoe, they said, created a breeding ground for isolation, vandalism, and crime.
The net result of all this quality design was, in fact, the production of an environment of fear.
Others attacked the welfare state, with big government the problem, and Pruitt-Igoe the result.
Film of that demolition has become an anti-public housing cliché.
This federal government of ours no longer has an open checkbook.
Many stated flatly that the residents were too poor, uneducated, or rural, that they'd caused their own problems and had taken Pruitt-Igoe with them.
Social as well as economic failure.
Long after the dust settled and the site was cleared, this is the Pruitt-Igoe that remained. The mythical Pruitt-Igoe with a fatal flaw, doomed to failure from the start. Little was said about the laws that built and maintained it, the economy that deserted it, the segregation that stripped away opportunity, the radically changing city in which it stood. In the years of Pruitt-Igoe, the American city was wrenched apart by devastating forces. They were felt most deeply by the residents of a large but vulnerable housing project on the north side of St. Louis. It's a powerful story with a dramatic end. And its aftershocks are still with us.
Good evening. You're here in Pledge Central, and it is a powerful story that you're listening to right now. And you're hearing it here on KBOO Radio. I know you're supporting that, so you're going online to kboo.fm to make your pledge of support. I'm Amy. I'm here with Ani right now. And we're asking you to do your part right now to support great radio like what you're hearing on the dial right now. And the best way and to do it right now is to do it online. Unfortunately, our telephone lines are knocked out because of the bad weather that's going on here in Portland. So please surf on over to kboo.fm, make a pledge, or walk on down to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. You'll know you'll be an active contributing member of KBOO.
It's so very true. It's a quick step for you to take over to your keyboard maybe from the keyboard in your pocket. However, wherever you are connecting to the internets, please do go to our website, kboo.fm, and click on that tip jar and donate, contribute to KBOO today. Think of yourself as a part of this whole. Together, we are stronger, and we can, in fact, provide each other with this independent community resource, this independent news and information station, also music and inspiration station, right? Mm-hmm. Because we bring it all to you. We have volunteers straight from the communities who are here really producing the content that you are relying on so that you can keep informed, so that we can stay together in really rather challenging times. And right now we have Hard Knock Radio. This is out of the studios at KPFA in Berkeley, California. And this is a program that is brought to us of views and interviews from the hip-hop generation. And it is important information. It's an important perspective. That's why you're listening. That's why you have already joined us with your attention span, with your ears, with your heart. Now we are just asking for you to close the gap and join us also with your pocketbook at kboo.fm. Go ahead and contribute. You can become a member of KBOO Community Radio right now at kboo.fm, or you can come on in 20 Southeast 8th. You'll have to use the little intercom phone and let the folks know that you are in fact here to take a tour of your community radio station, and you can see yourself as a part of the bigger picture. You can do that whichever way you choose. Just connect with us now, kboo.fm.
In the years after the war, they came by the thousands. Small farmers who couldn't make it on 40 acres. Tenants who saw a chance for their children up north. They brought them in the hope that in the center of so much wealth, there would be a place for them.
Mechanized labor had changed agriculture in the South. Tenant farmers, sharecroppers, and field workers could no longer scratch out a living. The new migrants arrived with little money or property. They were shepherded into the only place in which they were welcome. Distressed neighborhoods near inner-city jobs known as the slums.
You really had these people called slumlords who took advantage of the fact that the poor basically had to live in the center of cities close to where their jobs were. You had acres and acres of housing that was unsafe and unsanitary. By unsanitary, it meant a complete lack of the basic plumbing facilities. And by unsafe, it meant you could be burned to death. And the slumlords knew that they could just jam as many people as possible into it. So it was a very profitable system, but it was also completely destructive, not just for the people who were stuck in the slums, but for the whole urban community. And there was a despair that private enterprise could ever deal with this issue.
The door was open for a public option. Housing reformers pressed lawmakers to replace the slums with clean, modern housing, to re-energize the Depression-era housing program that had been stalled by the war. They found an unlikely ally in civic leaders and politicians who began to see the ring of slums as an eyesore that blighted the aging downtown area. Eager developers desired valuable inner-city land, while anxious business interests worried fearful consumers were being driven away by the slums.
The downtown interest just wanted the slums to go away. They didn't particularly care what happened to the people, but because they were wealthy and powerful, they were a very important part of the coalition that passed the 1949 Housing Act. The federal government would put up the money to buy slum property using eminent domain if necessary, to condemn not just individual houses but whole blocks and whole sets of blocks, to knock them down and to rebuild on a modern and humane scale.
When we first moved into Pruitt-Igoe, it was clean. Always clean. The maintenance men were always sweeping. The elevator was always clean. And I remember there was a quilted kind of a cloth that went on the elevator when you moved in so you wouldn't scratch it up. But the maintenance started to just go down and down and down and down until it seemed like that nobody cared anymore about Pruitt-Igoe. The maintenance men stopped cleaning the elevators. The kids got to where they would go in the elevator as the personal restroom.
I mean, many times these urine-smelled elevators, they'd stop. And you push the button all day long and nobody would come. So you'd be in this dark elevator. I remember me and my brother oftentimes stuck on this stupid urine-smelled elevator and couldn't get out. So what we learned to do was to push the doors open, find a little cable, and pull ourselves up to our floor and pull ourselves out of there. In fact, we became the guys who people would call when you needed to get somebody out of the elevator. We'd come and we'd push the doors open. You're down on that floor. You go down there and we'd help get them out of there.
They've been under considerable fire because of what is alleged to be, let's say, poor housekeeping practices on the part of the housing authority. How do you respond to that? What do you think is really the thing that's wrong here?
Well, in dealing with public housing, the problem that we find the most pressing is one I've talked about for quite a while publicly. The fact that we simply do not have enough money to operate as well as we should, perhaps.
What about this incinerator here behind us? Do you have difficulty with things like that?
Well, this is a building which will be cleaned. Every building cannot be cleaned at exactly the same moment. People working all day cleaning inside and outside. The incinerator is rather small, but it was built that way, and there's not much we can do about it. We do the best we can, and in most cases, it works quite well.
We pulled up with the moving van. The stench from the garbage piling up in front of the incinerator wafted out of the elevator, and I knew at that point that there was something drastically different about this living arrangement. The sight of all these huge buildings and all of these people, and just the overall non-upkeep of the place, it was a shock for me as a kid, and I never really recovered from that first day.
Almost from day one, these buildings were under-maintained. There was never an adequate provision for the maintenance that was so important to these very complex structures. Government paid for building them, but the maintenance had to come out of money from the rents of the tenants. And the tenants couldn't afford the very highly skilled maintenance people to keep these buildings operating. So in this very basic way, I think the public sector failed the people who were living in these buildings.
And you are listening to your community radio station, KBOO, with this special during the membership drive, looking at the spirals involved in gentrification in affordable housing and how communities change and undergo these transformations that affect the entire nation. It's the same story. We see it over and over and again. And you hear about it on your independent community radio resource, KBOO, here in this area, where you can go right now to our website and join us at KBOO.FM. I'm Ani. I'm here with Amy, and we are asking for you to stop what you're doing for just a moment and to join with KBOO, your community radio station, adding your financial support to continue our grassroots broadcasting adventures. KBOO.FM.
You can also support us with your work, your volunteer efforts. It is a volunteer community radio station. Myself, I'm a host for the Prison Pipeline Show. It just aired, and I actually had no experience in radio. It's less than a year ago, actually. Now I've been producing Half Hour, and I did a membership drive special. So it's amazing, and it's for free. I just volunteer back the hours that I got in teaching and learning, and it's a really valuable service that KBOO provides, and it is because of members picking up their smartphone, picking up their laptop, or going on to their desktop computer, surfing over to kboo.fm, clicking on the tip jar or adding the slash and give, and then just donating. It's actually really simple. I'm making it sound more complicated than necessary. but it's really doing your support, your part to support great community radio, becoming part of a station that gets out the information that you need to know.
That's right. We're asking you to do the simple part, but the extremely important part of backing us with just a few dollars right now. $40 is our regular membership. $120 is an amount that you can do in easy $10 a month chunks. You can contribute monthly and sustain us at any amount that you would like to set that up with. $5 or more every month from your checking account or from a debit or credit card. Or a one-time gift of $40, $60, $200, $500, whatever it is that you have right now that you can say, yes, I can contribute this to my community radio station because I believe that community radio makes us stronger together. Because I believe in KBOO's values, which are peace, justice, democracy, environmentalism, multiculturalism, freedom of expression, and social change. If those are values that you share, and I'm going to say they are, that's why you're listening. That's why you've already tuned in with your ears and your heart. Now we ask that you tune in with your pocketbook as well. And just go ahead and support us a little bit at a time in a monthly donation or a one-time gift. However you choose to do it, we ask that you do it now. KBOO.FM. Or come on in, 20 Southeast 8th. We'll be here for another half hour or so saying, come on in. We'd love to give you a tour of the radio station and show you how it's done. You too can see yourself perhaps as a community broadcaster. If you're passionate about an issue or a topic, just like Amy here, you can get the training and you can become a part of our news and public affairs teams. You can do field recording work. There's all manner of things to be done by you, community members, and it all starts right now with your contribution so that we can keep the lights on and keep the signal going for everyone. KBOO.FM, the easiest way to connect right now.
And the radio station does come in free to you, but it's not free for us to produce. We've worked it out that it's $88 an hour, so maybe you could call in. Oh, sorry, go online right now. Our phones are down, so calling in is not an option. But you could make a one-time donation of the $88 that would be keeping us going for 1 hour online or 1 hour of time, or you can also break that out into monthly donations. I believe it's just over $7 each month if you were to.
Yeah, if you did like $7.50 a month, $7.50 a month comes out to $90 in a year. So you could do just a scooch more than an hour's sponsorship. And you can think about it that way. Your $7.50 every month keeps an hour of KBOO on the air.
It's amazing to
it's
be able
everyone
to.
Everyone adding together that makes it happen, right? There's about 45,000 people listening right now, and there's almost 5,000 of you that have become members of community radio. It is those 5,000 people that are keeping the lights on, that are keeping the signal flowing out the tower and straight to your ears. Now we want you to join them. Make us stronger together. KBOO.FM. It's easy. It's painless. You just go right there to the website and contribute one-time gift or break it up into monthly contributions. Again, whatever way is easiest for you, just see yourself as a part of this community radio station, KBOO. Go again once more to that website, KBOO.FM.
Listening to an excerpt from an incredible documentary, Pruitt-Igoe Myth. The Pruitt-Igoe Myth, focusing on the infamous housing development in the northern part of St. Louis that was demolished and became the symbol for the failure of public housing and urban renewal. But it's all this other issues and complications attached to that narrative that you just heard. And as somebody from New York City, from the Bronx, which is filled with housing projects, and I can finally remember the burning buildings of the South Bronx where I'm from, what I'm hearing here was what you heard back in New York. And what you heard in New York is what you hear in Chicago, and what you hear in Chicago is what you heard in other parts of the country. So much so that it just can't be simply put off on poor people not being able to take care of good things. Just can't be simplified and said that public funding of housing is the reason why things go bad. This is something that's systemic, and this filmmaker, Chad Friedrichs, really brings a lot of that out in this documentary. I think it's important because right now, with gentrification and the mass removal of people being pushed out of the quote-unquote inner cities into other places, I think you're going to see these narratives pop up again, and we should recognize them. We should recognize the steps that are taken or not taken around housing, the lack or the lack of affordability, how the society responds to that lack. All these things seem to be happening in a cycle. And I think these documentaries, along with the one that we talked about this morning, which was called The Throwaways, are important testaments at this point in time about what many people in this country are experiencing. These are important conversations, folks. And I know when you watch TV and you watch the mainstream and corporate-backed media and you have million-dollar pundits and multi-million-dollar anchors who will lie about things, talking to you, Brian Williams from NBC, their reality seems to be detached from what most people are going through. Trying to make ends meet. Working two and three jobs, just barely making it, can't make your mortgage. You lost your house in the past few years. Many people are on public.